Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Leadership Project with your host, Mick Spears. We bring you thought-provoking guests and topics every week to challenge your thinking about leadership. Our aim is to help you become the leader that you wish you always had as we learn together and lead together. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Leadership Project with your host, Mick Spears. Our vision is to inspire all leaders to challenge the status quo. We bring you weekly topics and thought-provoking guests to get you to stop, reflect, and think about what it means to be a leader in a modern world. Our aim is to help you become the leader you wish you always had as we learn together and lead together. Please enjoy the show. We have a very special guest with us today, someone that I've worked with before in the past and someone that is a true inspiration to me and I have to say an inspiration to everyone that she's ever worked with or come in contact with. Kimberly Abbott is the founder and CEO of an organization called Vested, and Vested's mission is to redefine what it means to be a millionaire. They want the term millionaire to mean people that have impacted a million lives rather than just the financial definition. And just, I could stop there and you can see just how inspirational that vision is and the mission that she's on. And we're going to talk in some depth about what Vested means as we go through the interview today. If that's not enough, as a young woman, she also founded an organization called Rocker, which was designed to give economic empowerment to women in India through economic empowerment and education. Her thesis when she was going through university led to the development of the world's most advanced artificial heart. She was listed in JCI Australia's top 10 outstanding young people, and she's an independent consultant to the United Nations. So for everyone at home that's feeling a little bit insecure now when you're listening to Kimberly's amazing achievements, the other thing I need to tell you is that she's one of the most humble people that I've ever met. So she does not go out in the world portraying all of these things, but these are her personal achievements. And I'm completely honored that she's agreed to talk with us today. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Kim. And Kim, if you can say hello to our audience and tell us a little bit more about your background and what leads you to be with us here today.
Yeah, thanks, Mick. Thanks for that lovely introduction. I feel like I don't need to or don't want to say any more than that. And it's an absolute pleasure to be here. As you mentioned, you were one of my first bosses many years ago at the start of my career. So it's really a pleasure to be here. I think, as you mentioned, so my brief background, I think, in history is I'm an engineer by background. I was one of only five girls, I think, studying mechanical engineering at the time, which honestly was not that long ago. It was probably only 12 years ago. And I started at university and it was during my time at university that I started social enterprise. I think I naturally had always wanted to solve problems. It was just about solving problems that mattered. So it was on a trip to India that I founded Rocker, which I ran for a few years with a bunch of other very talented students and the support of some good organizations. And then I think, I stuck with problem solving and I kind of fostered my tech and engineering career at Thales for quite a few years. And then I think I decided I wanted to solve problems that I believe mattered. If I was putting my energy and my efforts in every day, I felt like it wanted to be towards problems that I believed in and that I believed needed help and contribution and innovative solutions. So that was what was kind of led me to take, I guess, quite a big leap out on my own. So then I was hired by the UN. So I worked with the United Nations on kind of leading the data and tech development for them. And of course, I developed Vested. And it was all about, for me, you know, the world has so many problems, but it's, you know, there are plans. There's the UN Sustainable Development Goals. There's ways we get there. And for me, it was looking at, you know, where can I best support solving those problems using what I have, what I know, and channeling those solutions in. So that's kind of been the journey so far. I don't really know what's next sometimes. My ethos is always just, as long as I'm making an impact and I'm feeling like I'm adding value in the work I'm doing, I'm usually pretty happy to keep going.
That's a wonderful introduction, Kim. And what I see for the audience at home, what I see there is someone who at the heart of it is a very talented engineer, very innovative, but also very clear about her purpose in life, where she does want to create a meaningful impact in everything that she does. So people use the term socialpreneur and things like this, but what we see here in Kim is someone who uses her talents to make sure that she is actually doing things that do make a meaningful impact on the world, on society, and on people's lives. And I'm very proud that I was one of your first bosses. I can't for a second take any credit for your what you've done in your life, but I can tell you I'm immensely proud of what you've done, and so should your parents, and so should everyone that's ever had anything to do with your career should be so proud of everything that you've done, Kim. And I'm looking forward to unpacking that with you and sharing it with the world. So let's go back to university. This was actually something I didn't know until very recently. Tell us more about how your thesis led to developing the world's most advanced artificial heart.
Yeah, I mean, it's I went to, for those in Australia, I think I went to Wollongong University, an exceptionally good university and well known for engineering, particularly mechanical engineering. So I was a mechanical engineer, and even when I look at it now, I realize I chose to become, the reason I became an engineer, actually, I had quite a few people in my life that used to say to me, you're good at maths and you're good at science, why don't you be an engineer? And I thought engineering was roads and bridges and boring, completely boring. And it was actually a credit to I went on a summer school. At university, at high school, my science teacher at high school and my mom kind of conspired to send me on this camp. And it was on that camp we did a trip to Westmead Children's Hospital. And they showed kind of artificial limbs and prosthetics. And that's when I went, hang on a minute, that's engineering. You know, I can actually help solve problems and make a difference by being an engineer. And I realized that actually being an engineer places you in a unique position make a difference, because engineers quite literally are designing and building and coming up with these frontier technologies. So we actually have a huge amount of control and responsibility, you know, to put that to good use. So yeah, when I was at university, I did standard track mechanical engineering, and I got to the end of my, you know, end of my degree, and you do a year-long thesis. And of course, the university rolls out the standard industrial type topics to research. And I said, well, this isn't really why I got into engineering. I want to do a project, you know, more focused on, you know, the medical space. I was quite inspired by Cochlear and Australian technology. I literally, and this was, I think, a very formative lesson for me, actually, in that you do sometimes need to go after the things you want. You know, the university had said, well, these are your options. And when it was like, well, I don't want that, I went and found it. I emailed a very talented professor at the University of Queensland who had a startup which was building the world's most advanced artificial heart by the book. And I literally just emailed them and said, look, I'm interested in a topic. Would you consider it? And the answer was yes. I think that was another lesson, and if you don't ask, you don't receive. And I'm grateful for the university for supporting it. It was obviously outside of the scope of, you know, what they thought they had expertise in. But yeah, it was a tough year. But again, it was something that, you know, it was nice to kick me off on my journey of realizing that, you know, my talents and my time can really be used to help people. Sometimes if it's just tiny part, like a piece of research in a thesis that feeds the technology that, you know, some greater minds are developing. But yeah, it was a great experience. And like I said, many lessons kind of for me from that alone.
Now, those that listen to the show all the time and are following the Leadership Project movement would know that one of the things that we're very passionate about is diversity and diversity and inclusion. And something that you said caught my attention. You mentioned that you were only one of 12 women in your engineering cohort. When we look at diversity and inclusion in the world today, and we see a lot of companies are trying to make strides to get better gender balance in their organizations, what I'm still seeing is a big issue with gender balance across job families. So whilst the overall trends may be improving, and there's some debate about that as well, we're still seeing, let's say, women gravitate towards careers like finance, HR, et cetera, and less so into engineering. What do you think that we can do to get that message out? Like you said before, engineering is not boring. It's not roads and bridges. There's so many things that you can do in engineering. What can we do to influence more and more women to take up engineering as a career?
Yeah, I think you actually said it, Mick, is the thing that I have found has worked the most. So one of my passions has obviously been STEM and encouraging more girls and women to go into and follow this career path. And I don't want to broad brush the complexity of it, but the thing I have found that works the most is humanizing the profession. For whatever reasons, I have found, you know, many girls, they see the hard hats, they see the engines, they see the thing, and they think it is not for them or not for women. And they used to say things like, oh, why don't you explain that, you know, the cosmetics industry is one of the largest employers of chemical engineering. And I was like, I used to do that. And then I actually realized, and this is quite obviously, it was because it resonated with me, was for whatever reasons, they often say the psychology of women generally, care a lot about having, you know, jobs that are caring or matter. And I found the more I advocated for and explained, not necessarily what engineers do, but the impact of what they do, completely changed the view people have. You know, it's one thing to say you're building a bridge. It's another thing to say you're connecting two communities that have been isolated for years across a river in Central Africa. And I think that narrative flipped. And it was the same thing when, you know, I can even explain now to young people, sure, do I just work in data? Yeah, I work with data. But I'm working with data that, if those solutions work, will fundamentally, you know, whether it's the UN, where we're helping, you know, countries and missions in conflict. So I think that's what I found helped the most was, and it's not just exclusively for women, is what I realized. The more we talk about the impact of the work that's done, not necessarily the work that is done, but what that means, is what really, I think, starts to resonate with people more. And I have found particularly with women and girls, but I don't think it's exclusive to them.
Yeah, so great takeaway there, Kim, to everyone at home, think about the impact of what you're doing, the outcome, not necessarily about the craft. So we're going to talk about Kim in the data science area later, and we'll talk about Vested, and we'll talk about this CPAS project with the UN. And like she's saying, you think, oh, data scientists, what does a scientist do? But it's the outcome that is more important than just what the actual activity is. Question for you, out of personal and professional curiosity now, if we switch from diversity to talk about inclusion, as a woman in the engineering field, particularly as you're breaking in, did you ever have any kind of issue with inclusion or exclusion as you were breaking into that field?
Yeah, I think the inclusion part is the hard part. And I think many companies, organizations think, you know, getting women a seat at the table is job done. But actually, it's making sure then the voices are heard, that they're, you know, considered. And I think that's the hardest part. There's a lot of good work to make sure, you know, leadership programs are equally diverse. But I've often found, though, that alone, you know, it kind of didn't matter. So, yeah, I did find in particular, and I still do find, I'm a 30-year-old working in some, you know, pretty, with UN, pretty institutionalized and in the finance sector. And sometimes, you know, credibility or that can be hard. The greatest thing I've had, and this is actually probably a call out to already leaders or future leaders listening, is the greatest thing for me that helped solve that was people who were already leaders or senior in the room creating the space for you to, or, you know, kind of, you know, I used to say someone like, you know, it wasn't just about opening the doors for me. It was they literally, you know, basically walked me through and held the megaphone in front of me was the analogy I used once to explain. It wasn't enough for them to just use their connections. It was about, you know, making sure. And I still see that in meetings where, you know, I might have had a question or I might have spoken up and I might have felt it was heard, and having other people in the room kind of say, well, hang on a moment. I think there was something, you know, I think Kim wanted to say something or there was something there, have been to me some of the most profound moments I've had and that have earned the greatest respect for me and others. To, you know, I look to those leaders now in a different light. So I would definitely say the inclusion part, it's difficult. It still doesn't, yeah, it's definitely the part that still felt a lot. But I've seen that in others, and that in turn obviously makes me try and be very aware, particularly not just gender diversity, age diversity. Obviously, we work with a lot of interns at the UN, and making sure that everyone's voice is kind of counted and heard. But it's only because I've personally had great support, often more often than not, of people around me that kind of taught me and, you know, led. In that sense, for me to learn that too.
Yeah, certainly my recollection from back in the time that we were working together, I have to say to you that there are a number of us that saw something very special in you. People like Aggie Cost and Kathy Jenkins, Chris Jenkins, our CEO of Talis Australia at the time, we also saw something very special in you and we were championing your cause. My call to action for all leaders out there is to do that for sure, but it shouldn't be just a special case. It should be giving a platform so that voices are heard, right? So so Kim got that opportunity. I think it's wonderful, but it should be an opportunity that we give to all young people, to give them the opportunity to have their voice heard, to make them feel valued, to make them feel that they matter. And to ensure that they can voice their opinions, because they do have strong opinions and they do have, they're very values driven. And I think it's something for us all to take away on that.
And I think sometimes too, Meg, just to add to that, it's in the ways you least expect. You know, I think I did have brilliant supporters and people in Talis who I'll be forever grateful for those transformative experiences. You know, I think Aggie and I mean, Kathy's a great example. Kathy sits on the board of my current company, you know, and I speak to her every week. She's, you know, and I think, and it's often because they realized, you know, there's much they can do from their position of leadership, but there's a lot they can do also from a personal mentoring side. And that is actually where I've often said to, you know, leadership helping career-wise and opening doors is great, but leadership literally, you know, I say about, you know, Kathy once, I said she, you know, I said she will absolutely kick my ass when it needs to happen, because that's caring too, you know, pulling me up when it's not acceptable. But also, you know, being there to quite literally give you a hug sometimes. And I think for me, the leadership that I've held dear are the ones that I guess have they've taken the time to learn me as a person, and then how to support that, be it in ways I obviously sometimes didn't anticipate, and I don't think they did sometimes. But yeah, I would also say to leaders to think outside the box. It's not always about getting the young person the next promotion. That might not be the best thing for them. And things like that. Because I've had that many times. I got very frustrated once where I didn't get an opportunity. And in hindsight now, I was not ready for that. And it was not the best thing for me. And I actually am grateful I had people above me who saw that and knew that. But they also knew how to kind of support me, I guess, in you know, me learning and learning about myself to understand that that actually was the right call.
Yeah, that's a nice share for everyone as well, Kim. And some people can get impatient about their career, and sometimes things happen for a reason at the right pace, and the learnings that you take from it is really important the whole way along, that learning mindset. You got me really thinking about Kathy. I haven't seen her in years as well, and I think we should start a case right now that she needs to be a future guest on the podcast as well. I think we definitely need, I will reach out to her after this interview and touch base with her. I'd love to catch up with her. All right, so let's wind the clock forward a little bit now, and you go on a trip to India. How did that impact you personally, and how did that lead to the development of Rocker?
Yeah, I used to not like talking about this story, but now I think it's worth stating that I when I was at university, I signed up for a trip to go and teach, volunteer and teach in India. And I said I wasn't like telling a story because I honestly went with very little social intention. I went because it was effectively a free, you know, it was grant funded, a free trip to India. I was like, great, what a great way to see a country I've never seen. And, you know, I don't have to pay for it. And I get to do something nice while I'm there. And yeah, I mean, it's cliche to say that it changed my life, but you know, it did. And I think for me, so whilst we were there, I went with the 40K Foundation, who are a fantastic organization. And we were teaching in some of the most impoverished areas of Bangalore, central south India, Bangalore, as it's often known, and on the outskirts. And these people largely lived in granite quarries. So they mined granite 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. They earn about $1.50 a day, Australian dollars, for that work. And they literally mine with hammers and chisels. And we were going out there teaching, and this was my basically my biggest foray into impact too, was understanding that, you know, when we were out there, it was a woman in the village, Rani, who came up to me, and obviously they don't speak English, but we had a translator, and she pretty much was demanding, you know, you come here, you do all this stuff for our kids, but no one does anything for me. And I remember thinking, what do you mean? And I thought that, and I thought, here is a woman who is 40 years old, born and bred in that quarry, knows nothing of the world outside it. You ask those kids what they want to be when they grow up, they say a truck driver or work in the quarries because they're the only two jobs they've ever seen. They can't say doctor, they don't even know what one is. And then, but yet here was a woman saying to me, I know I am capable of more. Why somebody give me the chance? And she wasn't asking for charity. And that was my big, big switch of going, you know, we go and when you give charity, it's not necessarily, it's not sustainable. You can't continue to constantly give charity. And quite often it's not what these people want. And so basically Rani got me thinking, when we were there and there was another student, a nursing student, and together an engineer and a nurse, we kind of went, A, we need a way to help empower these women, but B, it needs to be in a way that's not charity, that's sustainable, that, you know, will basically self-sustain itself. And that was when the concept has existed for decades, but social enterprise, the idea that business and doing business can be a really sustainable way to create income, to create impact, but impact that basically funds itself. The better impact you have, the more the business grows. So yeah, we started Rocker from that. I guess as a quick summary, what we did, and this was the engineering side, the problem solving, these women, you know, these people live in granite quarries, they have nothing but granite. But granite's one of the hardest stones there is. You know, you can't cut it, carve it, shape it without any tools. So effectively, we figured out a way to turn waste granite dust into a clay, which we trained the women to make into jewelry and other items, which we'd export back to Australia and sell. Really simple business model. And the idea was that the women run the business. So they also learn kind of fundamental business skills at it. And the money that they earn, we learn a lesson very fast that obviously the monetary difference between Australia and India is huge. So, you know, we actually couldn't socially pay these women all the money that they earned because they were earning in a week, you know, in one day, basically more than what their husbands earned in a week. I love that. But socially, that's a big change. So we have to kind of ease into it. So what we decided to do with the rest of the money was to fund the education centers that we'd been working at. And so, yeah, I mean, what sounds inherently simple, it's a jewelry business effectively, was my first foray into understanding the role that business has in creating an impact. And of course, yeah, in leadership, I mean, we didn't really intend for Vested to become a massive thing. We were just trying to solve a problem for people we saw there. And yeah, it ended up being a kind of 3.5 year kind of venture and one that, again, you know, it was something I'm incredibly proud of, but learned a lot of things from as well. So what started out as a, let's just go and have a good month in India, turned into 3.5 years of running a social enterprise to empower women.
What a life-changing experience. And the whole world is better off because of that, Kim, because now you're on this course where you're clearly very socially responsible and everything you do is about trying to create impact. So I'm certainly glad that you took that trip, and I think the world is better off because of it and everything that's happened since. For everyone at home, one of the headlines I've heard about Rocker was it's about turning rubble into rupees. So taking what is essentially a byproduct out of the mining industry and turning it into beautiful jewelry. But the real key is the other things that Kim said, the economic empowerment. Instead of just giving a hand out and helping and propping up, etc., it's about economic empowerment of women in India, a culture that's interesting on its own level, about sustainability. So it's not just about a once-off activity, but something that they can sustain going forward. But I also loved what you said, Kim, about being so aware of the cultural implications of what you're doing. So what you were saying there about being aware of, well, this is a different culture, one step at a time. You can't change a culture from 0 to 100 in one go, and then taking the proceeds and injecting that into the education system. That was a masterstroke.
Well, I mean, to be honest, we learned the hard way, Mick. And I think that's what many people do find in this because, you know, we did. We went in guns blazing with a solution. We trained women. And to be honest, it wasn't until we had, I think it was 3 women quit. And I remember thinking, why would they quit? Why would they quit? We've given them a job. They have a great salary. And so we asked them, which is, you know, the very logical thing when you're working on the ground in humanitarian and communities, but it's ask the people. And so we said, well, why did you quit? And I'll never forget, it was Goindma, one of the women just looked at me and she said, because my husband asked me to. And that was when the penny dropped to me that, you know, I'm in a culture where women don't do anything without their husband, particularly in these villages and this caste, they don't do anything without their husband's permission. You know, I might take a new job and tell my boyfriend later, but not here. And that was when we realized I had built a business that we had fundamentally engaged with women on all levels. This was about them. They helped design things. We had never once engaged the men and spoken to the men. And that was our big learning to go, wow, we have misread the culture. We need to go back around. It took time. It put us back. But ultimately, it made it stronger because obviously by, and also them, I think, recognizing that we understood their culture a little more. But yeah, I mean, you know, you say it's a masterstroke, but it was a huge pain and actual learning there. But I think it was that in itself, though, shows that, you know, you do have to adapt and learn. You can't just force it or, you know, whatever. It was talking to the people and engagement, but yeah, fundamentally trying to understand and engage with that. And it worked. But, you know, it could have gone so much more wrong than it did, really.
I like that term, adapt and learn, and having that flexibility to be able to realize, oh, something's not right here, and being having the flexibility to be able to pivot it a little bit. Also like the lesson that you're taking there about stakeholder engagement, right? And perhaps have missed one of the key stakeholders and then going back and redressing that. What are your personal lessons from that experience, particularly around leadership?
I sigh, Meg, because it's probably one of my greatest and hardest lessons came from that experience, but I'll get to that in a moment. So I think for me, I was kind of thrust into, in a way, being a leader, and so Vested, sorry, Rocker was staffed by students. So the 40K Foundation kind of helped us out, and every month, every, you know, university break, students would go and volunteer and they would help us, which meant we always had a team of people who were not paid, but who were passionate. So I learned a lot about how you lead people who are driven by purpose and passion, and that, which is tough, because, you know, people are so personally and emotionally invested in what they do that when, you know, the hardest part of being a leader is the hard decisions and the saying no and, you know, admitting that, you know, things may not be working. So that, of course, was hugely learning. And even just leading, I'm quite a deep thinker as well, so I keep a lot in my head. But when you lead, you can't. You know, people need to know what you're thinking, and you can't assume they know that. So that taught me a lot around communication. But I think the hard lesson I'm referring to was, so Vested Rocker eventually needed to close down, which is a hard decision for anyone. And this was effectively I call it my Indian baby. And that as a leader was so tough because it feels like a failure. You know, you feel like a failure when you go, okay, we were having trouble scaling it. So we had employed a certain amount of women in a number of villages, and that was going great. But when you create these things, you have a vision that it can help millions. Just wasn't quite a model that we could get out of that. So admitting that the best people to take it forward and to consider a new way to run it was for us to fold it in under this larger foundation. So for me, I felt like I had personally failed my team and all the volunteers that had worked so hard on this. And I think for me, it's one of my toughest things too, was I felt like I had failed those women, that I had failed the women that, you know, Rani and the women we brought on. And many people said to me, you know, that the fact that you kind of train them and you bring them up and they'll be all right, and they said, but I don't think, I still sometimes haven't gotten past the fact that, you know, we went in there for years, we helped them, and then we had to leave. And I would hope in the idea that you say that it's sustainable, that they saw that as great, it's fine. But I still struggle sometimes to think, you know, do they feel like they were abandoned, is a strong word, but yeah, that I failed them. So that was a lot as a leader, to distinguish the difference between failure and sometimes a hard decision you have to make as a leader. It wasn't failure, it was actually just the right thing to do for everyone. But it doesn't always feel like that. The right decision is not always the one that's comfortable, that's lovely, that's the happy ending. And that has taken me many years to actually reconcile that and not see it as I failed and whatnot. I used to say too, when I did stop Rocker, I decided, the next thing I'm going to do, the next business I'm going to build, it's going to impact millions, because I felt like the fact I'd only helped 9 women wasn't enough. But that's 9, that's 9 people's lives. Like, those 9 lives matter. And that's the big thing I've learned now, and to say to people, you know, it doesn't matter if you only help 1 person. 1 person's life matters. And that, again, was a huge thing. So, sometimes it doesn't matter if it wasn't, millions or the billions of women in India. It doesn't detract from that. There was, it still mattered and it was still a great thing to do. So, yeah, that for me, that was a loaded question, Nick. But that has been one of my most formative leadership things. Perhaps scarred me for a little. I kind of retreat, but I decided to then focus on my engineering career for a bit. But I think that was it. It was emotionally a really tough thing to go through and reconcile, both as a leader, but as a person driven by impact and purpose.
There's many lessons there again, Kim. And the first thing I'll say to you is that's definitely not a failure. That's actually a success in everything I heard there. I also like what you said about impacting one life. It's still impacting one life, and in this case, 9 lives. And then what goes on from it from there. I'll share a personal lesson back now because I've been in similar situations, Kim. Where I've had this happen a few times in my career where I've been a leader of a team and I've got a certain skill set that I know what it is. I know what my strengths are. I also know what my shortcomings are. I've got relatively strong self-awareness. I've had a number of occasions where I've been leading a business and felt like I've gotten it to the point where I've done the most that I can do for this business. Now the next best leader for this business is someone that's got a different skill set to me. And in this case, this is what you're talking about there. Folding it in under a different organization was probably the right thing to do at that point. And now look at what you've done, right? So in some respects, you've both broken. So Rocker has gone in this direction and you've gone in this direction. And it was probably the best thing for both of you. So I can understand the emotional charge aspect of that because it is your baby, and it's something that you'll always be proud of. But I think if you look back with hindsight, which I think you are doing now, probably the right decision for both. So the lesson learned.
Yeah, hindsight's a wonderful thing, Mick, but I do think you're right. And that's what has taught me a lot about knowing when, like you say, knowing your own self-awareness.
Yeah.
And that's something it's a current thing I'm working on, but tries to pull through in exactly what you said, Mick. Mm. Knowing when it's not. Sometimes it's the right thing is to say no and step away.
You've been listening to The Leadership Project with your host, Mick Spears. Join us each week as we bring you more thought-provoking guests. Don't forget to hit subscribe so that you are informed of all future episodes. If you are enjoying the show, it would be greatly appreciated if you can leave us a review and tell your friends about us. You are also welcome to join the Leadership Project Facebook community group, where we have an active conversation going about all things leadership. Please do take care, look out for each other, and always remember to challenge the status quo. Thank you for listening to The Leadership Project at mickspears.com. A huge call out to Faris Sadek for his video editing of all of our video content, and to all of the team at TLP, Joanne Goes On, Gerald Calabo, and my amazing wife, Say Spears. I could not do this show without you. Don't forget to subscribe to The Leadership Project YouTube channel, where we bring you interesting videos each and every week. And you can follow us on social, particularly on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Now, in the meantime, please do take care, look out for each other, and join us on this journey as we learn together and lead together.